committee, I met with Steve Marsh yesterday, and we went over some changes. He is reviewing them with people he needs to review them with, and we won't be moving the bill today. I'm happy to say we're making progress, and maybe by Thursday we'll have some Dash 14 amendments for us to consider and pass on. So for those that are here for 555, that's as much as we're going to do on it today. Next, we are in work session on Senate Bill 811. Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ted Ferrioli, for the record, State Senator from Senate District 28. When last we met, Senate Bill 811 was a reciprocity bill that would, in fact, allow folks from neighboring states with out-of-state handgun licenses to gain reciprocity under Oregon statute. And there were a number of questions that were raised by testimony from law enforcement officers about their safety if, in fact, concealed handgun licensees came from all of the other 49 states. How would they, in fact, check to see which of those licensees were active, and there wouldn't be a certainty of interface with all the different computer systems, et cetera. We met with the concerned individuals. We talked about how we could solve that problem, and the Dash 2 amendments are, in fact, an attempt to get at that very issue. The Dash 2 amendments involve a very focused change in ORS 166.291 that would indicate that the county sheriffs, instead of may, they shall waive the residency requirements. And Kelly's been reading from page 6 of the Dash 2 amendments on line 15. So it's page 6, line 15. And then further, that if instead of showing a compelling business interest or other legitimate demonstrated need in order to make application, which puts the burden of proof on the applicant and also gives the sheriff a veto power over that opportunity, the change would be valid concealed handgun license issued by a contiguous state. And colleagues, what that means is that if an individual who wishes to be legal under the carry provisions in the Oregon statutes wishes to make application, they have to first have a valid concealed handgun license from a contiguous state. So that certainly does narrow the application possibilities to the contiguous states to Oregon. And also, it would allow that individual from a contiguous state to make application under Oregon statutes for a concealed handgun license, meaning they have to meet the requirements for instructional hours, give their prove their identification, their get a criminal background check, and then submit the application to a local authority, which on approval would enter that information into the local computer system for law enforcement data, LED law enforcement data system, or the other systems that we use in Oregon. And so that would deal with the concern that law enforcement brought up, that they wouldn't be able to get accurate and timely information on folks that might be stopped in connection with a question on a concealed carry permit. So we think that these amendments address the issues that law enforcement brought forward. It addresses the issue of a relatively large universe of data requirements, and it subjects folks that already have a concealed handgun license in a contiguous state to the same statutes that Oregonians would be subjected to. It isn't reciprocity. It's an opportunity for folks to meet state requirements, the same state requirements that will apply to all Oregonians.
To me, what I'd like to point out that this person would have to meet all the other requirements that are in Section 1 except subparagraph C, which is his principal place or her principal place, is a county in the state. So the rest of the requirements are there.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question for our resident gun expert, Senator Burdick. Is this, can you tell us whether this is less expansive or more expansive or similar to House Bill 2535 in terms of this issue, or whether this issue was not raised in House Bill 2535?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, the 2535 in its current form would allow residents of non-contiguous states to apply, but it would be a may issue situation instead of a shall issue. This makes it shall issue. And it's my understanding.
Do they have to go through the background checks then? And do they have to go through all the steps?
Yes, they would. But it would be on a may issue basis. And the language about demonstrating a compelling need or some kind of business purpose within that county is going to be placed back in that bill to prevent forum shopping. When you don't specify that someone has to have a demonstrated need within the county, it allows people to come in from other states and find a permissive sheriff under the May issue. Now this one would deal with the issue by putting them under the. So and actually this would be a net weakening because they would have to issue it anyway. So I guess that part of it would be.
They still have to go through all the checks that any other Oregon resident would have to go through.
That's right.
The only change is that they don't have to be an Oregon resident because they're a resident, say, of the state of Washington. They still have to meet all the other requirements of Oregon. So I guess...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
They would not only have to meet Oregon's requirements, they would have to meet the requirements of a contiguous state for having a concealed handgun permit and have an active permit. So I guess Mr. Chairman, I would argue that it's not more permissive. The change would be that it is the same handgun license that is available to any Oregon resident. What we're doing is putting an additional requirement on that they also have to be licensed from another state, and we're putting a further qualifier on that it would only be allowable if it were a contiguous state or so. There's a very small universe of folks that could get this permit.
My concern with the original draft was that we wouldn't know what the other state's requirements were, and that could pose problems. With this, I think it's an improvement on our existing law because we have the assurance they've got to meet the Oregon requirements. So,
but the existing law leaves it to the discretion of the
sheriff. Right.
Right, and they have to show that they have a need for it. So this actually would allow more people to get permits than current law would.
But under current law, the sheriff had discretion. But the sheriff also was not required to make sure that they complied with the rest of Oregon law. If they had a Washington permit and he thought they had a legitimate business purpose, he could allow them to have a concealed gun in Oregon, as I understood the old law, or the current law, I guess.
Yeah, I believe they still would have had, under the current law, we have to go through the background check, as if... It would revert to the law prior to 1989 where they had to go through the background check and do all the checking. But but there's a further layer of sheriff's discretion. This means that if they pass the background check, the sheriff has to.
Mr. Chair, we have a question?
Yes, we have a question.
I move the dash 2.
All right, thank you. Senator Carno moves the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 811. Further discussion? Any verdict would like to be noted as objecting. Anyone else? Thank you, Senator Brown. Motion carries. Senator Tarno moves Senate Bill 811 to the floor to pass. Discussion? Please note Senator Burdick as objecting.
Scowling.
Motion carries. Senator Ferrioli will carry the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 3276A, and Representative Backlund.
Thank you very much, Senator Bryant and members of the committee. I am Vic Backlund, representative from District 33, which is North Salem and Kaiser. I'm here today to urge the committee to pass House Bill 3276A in gross. This bill has several features. One, it makes it unlawful to possess or to use an inhalant for the purposes of intoxication. Two, the first offense would be a violation resulting in a fine and or treatment. Three, the second and subsequent offenses are Class B misdemeanors, resulting in required treatment in addition to a possible sentence by the judge. Four, the bill would direct the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs to develop education resources for parents and others on the problem of inhaled abuse by minors, and for retailers who sell products that contain inhalants. ODAP is directed to develop a warning sign that will be made available to post at the cash register. The ready availability of inhalants in a wide range of useful legal products makes inhalant use, or huffing, the drug of choice of many young people. We have discovered that there are over 1,000 products that can be abused by huffing. Air deodorants like Glade, whipped cream canisters, hairspray, gasoline, computer cleaner, cigarette lighters, the breath spray Banaca, among others. The list seems endless, and most of these products are cheap. Kids don't have to find a street drug dealer to get them. The National Inhalant Prevention Coalition in Austin, Texas, estimates that more than 1 million Americans used inhalants to get high last year. Surveys of Oregon 6th, 8th, and 11th graders show that up to 29% of students in those grades have used inhalants. The dangers of inhalant use by young people are so high and so serious that we must mobilize to prevent youth from abusing substances such as butane and acetone. It is a very difficult problem to deal with, and one that people need to know more about so they can talk to their kids. It's a problem we must work together to solve before we needlessly lose more valuable lives. Inhaling vapors is a horrible problem that in January caused the death of James Stolberg, a Kaiser teenager, a senior at McGarry High School, who breathed butane fumes. James was a student in my school. I had taught his older brother and sister. James was a good kid who believed the wrong message from some of his friends and took a wrong turn that cost him his life. His death was a terrible tragedy, but we're hoping that some good can come of it if we can get something done to prevent other children from doing the same thing. 37 states currently have passed legislation about inhalant abuse, making it a misdemeanor or felony, punishable by fines or jail terms. Some states require education programs. Some require registry of sales of some inhalants. Five require treatments. And Arizona, Minnesota, and Texas require signs to be posted where inhalants are sold. Warning signs will raise public awareness of the problem and will prevent information to youth who don't know that fumes from even common products such as whipped cream toppings and cleaning solvents can cause instant death. Kids mostly get information about drugs from other kids, which means for the most part that they don't get the right information. We need to do something to educate children about the dangers of inhalants at places where they buy them. It is also important that any person found using inhalants get treatment and counseling as soon as possible. Anyone using inhalants is in extreme danger and in need of professional help. Parents and the general public must become aware of the incredible danger of inhalant use. We feel that the House Judiciary Criminal Committee did good work on this bill. We have proposed an amendment that inserts an emergency clause to the bill. We think you have that in your possession, and I would certainly appreciate your consideration of this bill. To conclude, I believe that the need for this legislation is urgent. It will give parents, school officials, and law enforcement the tools they need to combat the growing problem of inhalant use. I urge you to pass House Bill 3276A in gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Vic, for our edification, how do youth trap the gas and use it to get high? I mean, you think of whipped cream and some of the other things you mentioned. I'm trying to imagine how it's done.
We have discovered that what normally happens is these canisters are sprayed into a sack, a paper sack, and then it's trapped around the nose and mouth, and they breathe those deeply, and the inhalants therefore can one affect the brain to the point that the brain stops working, or two, the lungs malfunction and people die. One out of five people who die from inhalant use are first time users, And I think that's the main way that they would get high.
You've just been handed an apparatus, I guess, that facilitates this in some way.
Yeah, and we're not going to do this, of course. Yeah. But if this were sprayed into a paper sack, and then the paper sack would be closed so that the inhalants, butane, acetone, whatever, would be trapped in the paper sack, and then inserting the face into the bag, this is the common way it's done.
The emergency clause applies to all of the bill except Section 2, is that correct?
Yes.
So the criminal portion of it is would be immediately effective on passage, and then the rest would be January 1, 2000?
Yes, excuse me. My protocol isn't real good, Senator Bryant and Chair. Yeah, yes, we did that because it would take some time for the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse to ready their education programs and to make their signs. And also the merchants, the retail merchants who would advertise this would need time to be educated on the entire problem. And so we chose to go that direction for those reasons.
Are there questions for Representative Backlund?
Yes.
Thank you. First of all, I want to commend you for introducing this legislation. I'm the parent of a middle school daughter. And I looked in my refrigerator the other day and the whipped cream had gone dead. So I'm sure that was a good explanation for it, but I think this is very necessary legislation. I did have a question, though. I saw that the initial version applied to only people 18 and under, and it was revised. Why was that done? Is this a problem with adults as well?
Senator Burdick, we did that. The thought in my mind essentially was younger people, kids in school essentially, but it is a problem that extends beyond that age group, and we wanted a way to not only educate, but to give judges authority to direct treatment and counseling, and many people who have done this for a period of time are addicted, and so we decided to make it inclusive.
Yes, are these things actually addictive, or is it just the habit that's addictive?
Senator Bryant, Senator Burdick, we understand that they can be addictive. They are addictive.
Didn't know that. Thank you.
When I was
in fact, yeah, we were horrified when we did a lot of research and we read that people would be huffing or sniffing gasoline fumes, among other things, and somehow. Somehow gasoline fumes are not very appealing to me, but for some, they do get addicted on that.
Referring back to when we went to school, it was a certain type of glue that was rumored.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Airplane glue.
Airplane model.
Yeah.
So, but that was in a tube and couldn't.
Well, that's what you put in the bottom of the paper sack, Mr. Chair.
Ah.
Things will be not from the...
Well, see, you were more advanced at your school.
Not a very pretty death.
No, I can imagine. Other questions for Representative Backlund? Thank you for testimony.
Thank you for having me here. I appreciate your attention and your questions very much. Thank you.
Next, we have Kathy Osborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. Juvenile Rights Project is neutral on this bill, but I do want to point out a few situations. There are many ways that huffing occurs. The paper bag actually usually has a rag at the bottom of the paper bag to actually absorb whatever liquid is being expelled from, like the paint or something like that. Otherwise, your paper bag doesn't last very long. The container here is actually for direct into the mouth. It's a whipped cream container that also can be sold for the purpose of making club soda, where the capsules are put into the canister, and then the canister, the gas is released and can be sucked through the tube into the mouth. And then there's also the usual glue sniffing. Things you learn. the other concern that, I mean, although these substances can be psychologically addicting, they aren't physiologically addicting as most other substances, controlled substances are. It's the psychological high that becomes addicting, not actual the craving for the substance. So in the research that my office did on this, what we found is that most treatment centers would say that this is actually a fairly easy addiction to do treatment for, because you don't have to overcome the physiological cravings for the substance. It's just merely dealing with the psychological cravings, which they have to deal with in any treatment program, but you don't have to deal with the withdrawal symptoms or the physiological symptoms, which often causes the relapses that you find in most other treatments. The only thing I would point out is in section 1, subsection 5, sub D, it talks about that the juvenile court may require treatment and counseling if it's the second violation for this. What I want to point out is in Oregon, there is an amazing lack of drug and alcohol treatment for juveniles. Right now, the waiting list for most residential treatment programs is about 6 months long for a juvenile to get into a residential treatment facility. The way we triage our treatment beds in Oregon for juveniles is the highest priority goes to the youth that are using IV drugs. For obvious health reasons, we want to deal with those youth first, so that youth who are merely huffers in terms of the treatment list are going to be way down on the priority list. And so a juvenile court may require that a minor receive the treatment, but to actually get the treatment is going to be very difficult. The fact is that unless the parents' insurance will pay for the appropriate treatment for these kids, the juvenile departments are not going to have the resources available to treat huffers. And that's certainly been in my experience with dealing with kids who are huffers, and that's causing their delinquent activity. Trying to get those kids into treatment is kind of like trying to find a needle in a haystack that encompasses the entire state. It's just, I mean, I don't want this committee, we're neutral on the bill, we think the bill, there is a problem certainly with kids that are huffing, but don't think that when you pass this bill, these kids will then start getting into treatment, because they won't. I can't get treatment for my clients who are addicted to methamphetamine. So don't think that if I can't get kids who are addicted to methamphetamine into a treatment program, the huffers are way down on that list.
What would be your estimation of the scope of this particular problem and its expansion in the last couple of years?
Chair Bryant, in my experience and with speaking to some doctors at OHSU that our office spoke to trying to get some information when this bill was over on the House, what we see is that this activity usually peaks in adolescent boys around the age of about 14. Now, that's not to say that there are no adult huffers, because certainly there are, and the fact that it is legal to have these materials and these materials are readily available certainly increases the use of huffing. What the doctors, however, told us at OHSU is it's not a socially acceptable form of addiction, in a very strange way of saying that. So this isn't something that you go to a party and there's lots of huffing going on. So that's why we usually see it peak around the early adolescent years and kind of taper off in the lower adolescence. Now, again, I'm not saying that you don't see it in adults and you don't see people who chronically huff, because you do.
Well, I don't know if this relates to this, but when I testified last week, and I testified in front of this committee on a bill that came out of the committee on driving under influence, remember, we added inhalants to that. We did not try such drugs. The DUIIs have leveled off. Yeah, but the number of DUIIs inhalants has increased by 65%. So I don't, once again, I think this, it does somewhat answer your question, Mr. Chair. There's been a dramatic increase. According to law enforcement officials, state police, county sheriffs, the number of people who are being pulled over the side of the road that are under the influence of some kind of inhalant as opposed to alcohol.
And if I may address that, Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, that I think somewhat the increase in DUI for inhalants increases because we're able to, the detection ability is greater for the police officers, where before they weren't able to detect those, so they weren't able to note them or record them anyway. We now have better detection capabilities, so we are seeing an increase, and it might be more about the increase of detection rather than increase of use.
Don't worry that she always shoots me down. You know what I'm saying? I cannot say a single word without her coming in with some qualification. It's like some duper. And she's playing that game with you.
Well,
later. You're the elder.
I'm sorry. I'd rather than on the public record.
Maybe I should have asked the representative back of this as well, but how long does the high last with these things in terms of...
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, I'm not speaking from personal experience here. But it's my understanding it's actually a very short-lived high, which is one of the problems with the huffing, because it does have, I mean, it has an effect on your lungs. You're taking a foreign substance into your lungs. But because this high is a quick high and then going down, you take more of it into your lungs because you're trying to get successive highs rather than one high that lasts a long time. So that adds to the danger.
I was thinking more of the driving thing we did last week. And wait a minute, maybe it doesn't last that long. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, well, we had, I think there was a test going to the outside of someone actually driving and huffing at the same time. So it's encouraging. Thank you for the testimony. We'll close this public hearing on House Bill 32. Yes, Doug.
Do we have another witness?
Yes, we'll reopen the public hearing. And who would you like that to be?
We were going to pass it out there, Coach, just so you know. But you know, Coach, I hope you didn't. I hope you got this. It's called signals. You understand what I mean, third day, Coach? I thought it was a signal of steel.
Okay. If you could identify yourself, please.
Good afternoon, Senator Bryant, members of the committee. I had come not prepared to speak, but I feel compelled to at this point. My name is Carla Moyer. I'm Salem Kaiser School District's Prevention Education Specialist. And as such, I oversee curriculum to prevent drug and alcohol and abuse and violence in our schools. I agree with the previous person who testified that inhalant use peaks at eighth grade. That certainly is what the statistics show from the drug and alcohol survey that we do yearly among our students. It goes down considerably at the 11th grade level, which is the next age that we give the survey to. Where I disagree with her is the connection to residential treatment. Very, very few 8th grade students who are involved in any kind of drug use require residential treatment, thank God. It is at that age. The level of treatment can be education or weekly outpatient treatment. As I say, it would be quite unusual, I believe, for an eighth grader to require residential treatment. Some do, but for the majority of young people who are experimenting with inhalant use, outpatient treatment, even some that we might be able to provide at one of our facilities in the school district, would be what would be recommended by the person doing the drug and alcohol assessment. And so I would be disappointed to see this bill go down because of the lack of residential treatment for children experimenting with inhalants. In Marion County, the type of outpatient treatment or education that most inhalant users would be referred to are available with a short waiting period and sometimes immediately available.
Well, the bill won't go down. It's just a question of whether there'll be money to have sufficient treatment facilities. So the bill would still pass, but there may not be any expansion of treatment facilities.
And as I say, very few would actually need a residential treatment. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We will now close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3276A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3276A
amendment. A9 amendment.
Chair, move the dash A9 amendments to House Bill 3276.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. Moves the dash A9 amendments to 3276. Discussion? Objection? Please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3276 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Thank you. The motion is due pass to the floor. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Courtney, would you like to carry the bill?
I will carry the bill.
Thank you.
Can you do the stop with the court bill? 2555.
Okay.
This is request day.
I'm doing 841.
Senator, without objection, Senator Courtney would like to vote on Senate Bill 811. Senator Courtney?
Votes yes.
Senator Courtney votes yes. Without objection? Orders. Thank you. She's unsigned for today.
Which one were you mentioning?
2555.
We will now open a work session on House Bill 2555. Mr. Channel.
I think this is Aaron.
It is.
Mr. Chair, I can talk quickly.
Okay.
I just to get a little history, I thought it would be interesting. This bill is the product of Del Parks, even though he doesn't know it. In 1993, Del introduced a bill that required courts to consider earning capacity when parties were divorced as part of the spousal support award, and it was a mandatory award. A few years, I think it was one or two sessions later, after the good representative left, we changed it to a discretionary award. This is Ron Gewirtz's fix of all of that, and what he's done basically is put spousal support into three categories. One is transitional, and that's for folks who need have been married for a period of time that would be appropriate for award of spousal support and need some assistance getting back on their feet. The second is compensatory spousal support, which is really the enhanced earning capacity where someone's put someone through a neurology program and made them extremely lucrative in terms of earning capacity, and then they split up and give some criteria there. And the third is maintenance, which is for those marriages. I mean, I remember having one divorce where the parties had been married 40 years. And a long-term marriage where one party has been out of the workforce for a long period of time and anticipated to be permanent spousal support. The reason why this bill is so critical is that what I see happen and what I saw happen is that in a lot of cases, there's a lot of discretion out there in judges, so you see a wide variety in spousal support awards around the state. This limits the judge's discretion but gives them some flexibility within the sort of framework of those three types of awards. It also puts Oregon sort of back. Oregon and Iowa are the only two states that considered the enhanced earning capacity the way we considered it. This puts Oregon with the rest of the states in terms of using it as a criteria and not as a mandatory award. So it's a really good bill, and we do have some amendments.
And we are in work session, so if you want to offer those amendments at the same time, I'll pass a letter from Russ Mackenzie, who used to be the chair of the Oregon State Bar Committee, which supports these amendments.
I frankly don't know what the amendments do.
Taylor, because this is an Aaron's bill. He's on his way. And by the way, Aaron is leaving us. He found a job with, I think, the Benton County
District
Attorney. So on the end of May, he's
that's correct.
Turns into a
hunter.
Turns into a second.
She said, didn't we do another bill that Del Parks had done earlier in the year? Or
yes, it was earlier in the year. I'm trying to remember.
It was the It was the marriage. It was the common law marriage.
Common law,
Del
Parks.
Yeah,
this is different than that.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was Oregon does not recognize common law marriage unless someone dies and then it's after the fact.
Remember that was a factual scenario from the Del Parks.
Yeah, right. And that one widow we still protected because it's not retroactive.
That one was a doctor. A woman put the name
of Del Parks.
Oh, okay. She was from California.
While we're waiting for Aaron, why don't we take a look at the Dash 2 amendments, the A2 amendments, and they look technical.
Yeah.
They just, except for
page 10, that's the only thing. On page 8, it takes out entire section 3, but I can't tell you why. And page 10 is also deleted up until line 44. Yeah.
Oh, that's taking on some existing language.
No, I think that's just in the bill.
I think the deletions recite the fact of what was earlier deleted by the amendment.
Okay.
So I believe that in order, because of what they did on page one, then that required the deletion the rest of the way.
These are weird amendments.
It doesn't delete that. We're talking to the statute.
Why don't they just delete the section one or delete the page?
They did.
What happens by deleting the page is the remaining law is in a, so continues in effect. So just the bold print wouldn't be there.
Okay.
Oh, he didn't what?
I think he stepped out for a bit.
Oh. Well, should we go on faith with these? They look like,
I'm comfortable with them.
Okay. I'll move the dash two amendments, A2 amendments.
So the Brown moves the dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2555.
Yeah, just up to the door. Not that we need them, but...
Discussion? Objection for the bill.
I move House Bill 2555 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Thank you. Senator Brown moves House Bill 2555 as amended to the floor due pass. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Brown, would you carry?
I did.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, Peter, you had a favorite you wanted to call up next?
I did?
You were whispering in my ear.
No, I didn't.
I thought you did. We'll go to work session on Senate Bill 775, dealing with Kaufman. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill, I believe, comes from Senator Q-Tab, creates an interim, the dash two amendment, which creates an interim task force to make recommendations and submit reports to governor and legislative assembly on court-appointed special advocate volunteer program, directs the state court administrator and the state court commission and children and families to appoint members of the task force and supply the task force with staff. Nancy Miller is here on behalf of the court, as soon as we click. My understanding from talking to Nancy is that this bill would have minimal fiscal impact because the two state agencies would assume the cost within their current operating budgets. But Nancy could address further.
And Nancy, where's Nancy? You're in agreement with the dash two amendments?
One word.
Yeah, one word. This will be a first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Nancy Miller for the State Court Administrator's Office. As we discussed the last time we talked about this bill, it did have an appropriation in it, and it was taken out at the request of legislative counsel. I did notice in looking in my amendments to Senate Bill 555 today that there are appropriations in that bill, so I was just confused really about why the appropriation had to come out of 775, but I just wanted to call that to the chair's attention. If we have to live with it, we will.
You should live with it, because this way it goes over to the House rather than goes the other way than me.
I understand.
All right. The other appropriation line will remain in 555, so that it does go the other way than me. All right. The chair then would move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 775. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Before due pass, recommendation as amended.
Thank you, Senator. Courtney moves the bill to the floor, due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Q-Tub.
Yes, she won't talk to you anymore.
All right. We'll now go to Senate Bill 1066 committee. I talked to Senator Hartung. We've changed it from a Class A felony requiring death on the first grader to a Class B misdemeanor.
I move the dash.
Help.
Dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1066.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1066. Discussion, objection, order.
Move Senate Bill 1066 as amended before the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Discussion, objection, so ordered, and Senator Hartung will carry. The question is, you can allow your horse then to go to a place where they turn it into dog and cat food, correct? I believe you can.
And you can transport it in a cattle cow, that cattle thing that would allow the horse to break its neck on the way.
And you could. In other words, you're saying the cats and dogs need it, but the humans can't. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it just seems a little inconsistent.
We have some little lady.
And what makes you think life isn't inconsistent?
Oh, my life's not.
Oh.
What did they say? Consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds.
All right. We will now go to work session on Senate Bill 1304, and I'm going to have testimony because we gave this a very brief hearing some weeks ago, and then it was rescheduled with witnesses, and it was the night that we went to for 3 hours. So, and we had some people from out of town, and I should have noticed that earlier on my sign-up sheet. But we'll open then the work session on Senate Bill 1304. And as we listen, I'm not committed to moving the bill, but I wanted to take testimony and hear what people said. So let's begin with Ken McDermott and Tawny Johnson.
I want to ask you, how do you feel about yourself
today? I'm only one of the five. I have no problem.
Can I ask a question?
Yes,
Ken, I just have a quickie question for you, and it's not really... you work with Senator Stark, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. If I read the bill, and we've had some discussions in our office about it, and I know where the where it comes from, et cetera, my question for Senator Starrs, and just generally, and I'm not really looking for an answer, is we have a system of assistance welfare where we require women to go back to work after 90 days. And it seems sort of inconsistent to me that we would allow women, mostly women, caregivers as well, I assume that, but allow breastfeeding women, I assume women who can breastfeed, off of jury duty. At the same time, we require women on assistance to go back to work. So that I see that sort of as being inconsistent in terms of supporting the family, and just wanted to throw that out to Senator Starr and folks. And then, of course, I have to leave, so I can't even listen to you because we've got a meeting with the governor. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out for discussion. And I know what the problems were in Hillsborough.
We also have letters from several people, from Tawny Johnson and also from John Bonholzer, that have been through the committee. So, Mr. McDermott, why don't you begin?
Okay. For the record, Senator Bryan, I'm Ken McDermott, legislative assistant to Senator Starr. A little history on this bill. It was a letter from Tawny that first brought her attention to a difficulty she was having. Rather than go to her testimony, I'll let her speak for herself. Her situation was satisfactorily resolved. We did consider a bill that would apply just to nursing mothers. However, because Senator Starr is on the chair of Rules and Elections, Senator Lim then brought a bill up to be introduced through Rules and Elections that was going to be broader and would apply more to the way Senate Bill 1304 actually came out. We do have a proposed amendment that I believe you have a copy of, but we'll get to a little bit later. The letter from John Bonholzer brings out the difficulty, depending on how the presiding judge looks at this law, in a parent being excused, a parent who is the caretaker of their child. In looking at the separation of a parent and child, the Lalachi League material deals specifically with a nursing mother, and they have a lot of material there. I didn't reproduce all of it for the committee, but it's readily available. And then as far as older children go, I just took a quote from an author in this magazine article that I think pretty well summarizes it without reading the whole thing. It essentially talks about separation anxiety. With my children, we call that the mommy-only phase. We expected it. We anticipated it. At some point, the child begins to realize who mommy is as a distinct individual, and they begin to bond to mommy or whoever their primary caregiver is, and they really experience distress at being separated. Now, as the child matures, as they get older, they're able to expand their universe to be able to bond and to work with more and more individuals, but still the number tends to be fairly limited. We were often told that it's one additional person per year of age. So a five-year-old child can basically handle about five strangers at a time. When Tani's situation came to the attention of the Holly Banks, the staff writer of the Oregonian, she published an article about it. There was a very strong response, according to Holly Banks, the Oregon staff. It was one of the top three issues of the last year as far as public response went. That response was mostly favorable, about 70% favorable. There were some people who felt that they had to do it, she should have to do it too. We did check other states. The legislative material specifically referred to Iowa, where any nursing mother who's not employed full-time is automatically excused from jury duty. Florida exempts the caregiver of child 6 or younger. Texas actually goes to the caregiver of a child 10 or younger. Georgia legislature is moving a similar bill with a child of 4. Now, as we worked with this bill and we talked to Kingsley Click over at the Judiciary Department about their concerns and their issues, one of the things that came up was that this, as the original bill was, it was a little bit broad. You could have a single parent who was employed full-time, earning good money, child is in daycare all the time, but they could claim to be the primary caregiver and therefore claim an excuse. And that was really the focus here. We realized that the employment issue wasn't the issue. The issue should be, who is the child bonding to? The amended, the amendments, the dash one amendments you have in front of you, focused on that by specifying it has to be the person who is caring for the child during the normal hours of operation of the court. Another issue that was brought up was the issue of civic duty. In considering this, we felt that really raising a child is a civic duty of its own. The courts don't want to start a laundry list. Apparently, previous to 1984, I believe it is, there was sort of a list of various exemptions in statute. They went away from that to a case-by-case hardship situation. However, they did put in an exemption specifically for those who are over the age of 70. And what was interesting to me is that wasn't done on the basis that those over 70 are somehow physically unable or mentally unable to attend a jury duty, but rather that they have already fulfilled their civic duty. They've been in the country, they've been paying taxes, they've been to courts.
But how do you do that? He might have been in the country 1 month and turned 70.
Well,
that'd be unconstitutional, because then you're also limiting people who are older from serving on a jury panel.
Chair Brent, that's true, but that was already there, and that was the rationale they gave us for doing it that way.
I don't think that would withstand constitutional scrutiny in Oregon.
Well, I don't know if it's been challenged. We were looking at the issue of civic duty in raising a child. In some ways, I hate to go back to all these tragedies we've had, but the question always seems to come up is, where were the parents? We seem to have a sense as a society that parents have a responsibility to take care of their children. If you're simply in a store and you see a young child running around, apparently on its own, frequently one of the first questions you ask yourself is where's the parent? Who's taking care of this child? I have a quote there again from the magazine, and I would just read the last part where it says, therefore, parents have a moral responsibility to the community to invest themselves in the proper upbringing of their children, and communities have a similar responsibility to enable parents to so dedicate themselves. And that's the focus here. We're trying to look at parents who, for whatever reason, whether it's a financial reason, whether it's a inability to find appropriate child care, they personally have taken on, or one parent has personally taken on, the care of that child, and that to then put them in a position of having to go to jury duty disrupts the care of that child, and they then have to somehow come up with an alternative method. It's disruptive to the child, it's disruptive to the parent, and in most cases they have to come up with a third family member now who has to take time off of work or whatever. I would agree that in most cases we would think that that would automatically be covered under ORS 10.050, which is that hardship exemption. However, in John Banholzer's testimony, which you have before you, he makes it clear it's very difficult to have that apply. That you have to, first of all, show up in court, which he did with the child, and was told he had to leave. He couldn't have the child there. He was able to make some arrangements. He did go for almost 2 weeks of jury duty. On the Thursday of the final week, he went to the court and said, I just can't make it tomorrow. And the court said, well, if you can't make it tomorrow, you have two choices. You'll either be held in contempt, or you're going to have to serve 2 more weeks of jury duty. He served 2 more weeks of jury duty. Finally, one of the concerns that was addressed was the size of the affected group. Of course, the latest census figures are from 1990. And if we adjust for current trends, the actual number of people who would be covered under the -1 amendment, at any rate, would be less than 3%. The number's a little hard to pin down because the census doesn't specifically ask that question. We have to look at how many parents are there where both are employed full-time, one's employed full-time, none are employed full-time, etc. I would want to make the point, and I think Connie's made this and John did in his letter as well, that these aren't parents who don't want to fulfill a civic duty of being in a jury pool, but they feel that caring for their child is a priority. They've made arrangements to do that. They've restructured their life to do that. And they want to be able to continue to do that until that child is old enough. And in this case, we chose the age of 6, simply because by the time a child is 6 years old, they're generally going to be in school for almost the entire day. That's the basic points I want to bring to your attention. If you have any questions, we have to answer them. And Tanya's available for her testimony.
Tanya, why don't you go ahead and testify, and then we'll open up for questions.
Chair Bryant and members of the committee, you have my testimony before you, and you've probably had a chance to read it, and not to be wordy and go on and on, but basically, I'm in favor of any amendment that would change 10.050 as it stands now. My situation, in a nutshell, was I was deferred once when I was pregnant. I was almost 6 months pregnant. I was deferred from jury duty with a letter to the judge. I was working as a nurse in a family practice clinic at the time, and I had taken off numerous days for complications earlier on in my pregnancy, and I was told by my employer that if I was on jury duty that I would have to dip into my leave pay, and I could not afford to do that. The presiding judge did defer me, and I was deferred for five months. And I didn't know how the deferral process worked, and so in 5 months I received another postcard for my summons, and at that point I had a new baby, and I was at home with that child, the same child I have now, full time, and so I took myself and my child into the courthouse and said, you know, this is my situation, they deferred me, and they said, well, we are going to call you up in another 5 months, and we will not defer you again. And I said, however, my situation will be no different, and because I've made a choice to change careers, and I actually have a business in my home and work for a group of physicians out of my home. Instead of doing nursing, I'm doing computer work. I kind of had a threefold problem. I not only was caring for my child full-time, I was also running a business at night while my child was sleeping, and I also was nursing my child. And I, because choosing to be home, had no one to care for my child. I didn't have daycare options. And one of the reasons why I decided to stay home, the first one being I wanted to raise my own child, was that I could not afford daycare. And so I was told by a clerk of the court I was told by the clerk of the court when I went in the second time that I would be deferred under 10.050, and that if my circumstances were the same as they were now, that it wouldn't be a problem if I would just write another letter to the judge. So I left there pretty secured in that I wanted to fulfill my duty that when my child was at an age where I could do so. So I received yet another card this March stating that I needed to report to jury orientation, and I wrote my letter, and about a week later I received a third postcard saying that my request had been denied and that I needed to make arrangements to show for jury orientation. I called, explained my situation on the phone, and I was told that the individual I spoke to had been terminated from Washington County courts, and that what I was told was void, that there was all my problem, that I should have taken care of my problem 6 months ago, and that nursing my child was a problem, that I should have weaned my child to prepare for jury duty, and that it did not matter that I had no care for him. And I was told point blank that if you do not show for orientation, we will have someone come and arrest you and put you in jail. And my father has been a police officer for 30 years, and so I called him frantic and said, how can they throw me in jail? And he said, well, I have heard of them sending officers to people's place of employment and to their homes to bring them in for orientation when they fail to show. And he said, but I can't imagine they would do that to you. And so my story began. I feel like I was handled terribly, and I explained that I do want to do this. This is my duty, but how can I do this if I have no care for my child? And later I was told, well, we'll make accommodations for your child to be brought to you. I had no one to bring my child to me. And so I asked, can I be deferred until he's a little bit older? And again, I was told, you know, no. And I couldn't understand why I was not falling under 10.050 as a hardship. I mean, clearly there were three or four circumstances that I thought would put me into that. And my biggest concern was what would happen to my child. And so I would love to see this be made a choice for parents. If you called to jury duty, could it be a choice that you could do this now, if you could make arrangements, if you are taking care of your child full-time at home, even part-time, depending on the hours that you would be called for jury duty. And if you could be deferred or excused, then you would be held to serving your duty, you know, when your child is age six and in school and not in need of your constant care during the day. And for people who have chosen to stay at home, you don't have a backup plan for daycare normally because you're it. And so really, financially, it's a burden and a hardship, and then you worry about your child, too, and trying to find good care for your child, and you don't want to introduce a perfect stranger to them and hope that things will be okay. And I also understand, and I was told numerous times, that you may only be needed 2 to 4 days out of the 2 weeks, but that's 2 to 4 days that I don't know what to do with my child. And if my child's brought to me, who's going to do that? Well, we'll make allowances for you to leave and pump. And so I would have to flag a bailiff and, you know, put everybody in the courtroom on hold and leave. And going to nurse your child isn't just a five-minute ordeal. You have to change your diaper, and then you'd be shuffling them off with someone else for the remainder of your day. So I feel badly about the turn of events. I am just in hopes that no parent ever has to go through this. I think that it was handled terribly, and it really gives our court system to a poor representation. I just think it's unfortunate. And I've had numerous calls, and in fact, patients I used to care for who are now moms, some of them nursing, some of them not, some of them stay at home, some of them not, have all called and said, you know, this is a problem, and maybe it's been a problem for others, but no one's ever said anything. So I think it's important to look at this and make some sort of change.
Colleagues, I get involved in this a couple times a year, and of course I've been called for jury duty before, and I get requests from usually professionals, doctors, dentists, others who have, you know, booked months in advance, and they don't think it's fair that they be called, and I explain to them they have to serve, and the arrangements we make in Deschutes County is the judge will excuse them for this current set, but then in the next 3 months they have to block out so many days from their practice to come and serve. And being on a jury is an inconvenience to anyone. No one wants to do it unless you have absolutely nothing else to do. And usually it's not a very pleasant task either, especially if you're involved in a criminal matter. So the judge is in a difficult position because he's dealing with
or she's dealing with a lot of people who would not like to be there. And so usually they're fairly hard-nosed in whether or not to grant it. Now, your particular problem in Sheep County, no one's raised. So again, I think it goes probably judge to judge, courtroom to courtroom. But for instance, on pregnancy, to me, just the fact that you happen to be pregnant wouldn't necessarily excuse you. If you had complications, you're late term, those sorts of things, that would excuse you. But so your dash one amendments to me are still too broad. And Mr. The gentleman who wrote, Van Holster, I'm less sympathetic to him than I am to you, because I realize that it is an economic problem too, because you have to hire some daycare while you're there. But if you're given the opportunity to book that in advance, and again, this is my Deschutes County experience, the court would tell you what days you're going to be called. Now, in my particular instance, I was called four times. I was bumped four times. Nobody wanted an attorney on their jury. And Mary's been called twice in our 26 years, and she's never served on a jury either. No one wants the wife of an attorney on a jury. But what we're experiencing in Sheep County is more and more older people are serving on the jury, because we have a lot of retirees, and they have the time, and it's less of an inconvenience. But that's also a concern, because a jury is supposed to be a cross-section of the community. And so as we consider this bill, I'm glad you made the changes so that someone who is used to using daycare, I mean, this should be not a great inconvenience for them. But I think there's also, in certain circumstances, an obligation for those who are raising their own children to find that daycare if they can schedule it well enough in advance. And, of course, it has to be something you feel comfortable with. Other questions or comments for these witnesses?
I have a comment.
Yes. Thank you, sir.
Just a couple things. First of all, one of the things that surprised me about what Tawny just said about being told she should wean the baby from nursing is a real example to me about how incongruent are the laws that we pass here and others that somehow set standards in the community differ, because we just passed a breastfeeding law that women should be able to breastfeed in public, that it's a good thing, and she's being told, well, you know, after 6 months you should have weaned your baby so you can come on jury duty.
Well,
Thanks.
No, and I think that is clearly an inappropriate comment. And clearly the statute doesn't require that here. That was just someone's interpretation.
But I had to comment about that, because this is an example of how we're, you know, how we say one thing here and we perform so differently in another setting. But I would comment to the statement that you made about nobody wants to serve. I have always thought it'd be great to serve on jury duty, and if you're employed and you're paid, maybe it is a financial hardship, because you certainly don't get paid the rate you would if you were working. But I find it extremely interesting. And the thing is I've only been called once in my life. It seems like the people who don't want to serve get called and called and called. And the ones who do want to serve never get a notice. And they're just dying to go sit. I mean, you know, they watch Judge Judy and Koch and everybody else on TV to get their fix of, you know, serving in this justice system. And so something must be wrong with how they...
You have to pick them randomly.
And then one other thing. I would agree that just being pregnant is not a reason not to serve, but with Tawny, it was the issue that she was told she'd have to use this as a portion of her leave, and she knew she was going to have to use all the leave that she could when she had the baby. So while it may be just one judge who's reacting in this case, what it does, we do very often, we make laws based upon what one case is, to make a standard throughout so it doesn't happen again in other places. So, I'm generally supportive of what you're trying to do here.
Senator Bryant.
Yes. If I may, the issue of whether or not the person is pregnant was part of the original bill at the suggestion of John Denholzer, as Senator Lynn wrote it. That particular question really hasn't even been discussed. It's not something that we're necessarily saying has to be done. There's a broader question, which is, if you present your hardship case and the judge doesn't agree, if that is contempt of court or serve. And there's no, at this point, there's no appeal process. There's no way to go to another panel of judges or something else.
Well, the process is, if you disagree with the contempt citation, then you're entitled to a hearing in front of another judge. The difficulty in that is it's a contempt citation,
mm-hmm.
and you can be fined. Technically, you could be put in jail. That's not going to happen. But it also would probably require you hiring an attorney so that you're well represented in that contempt proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the de facto appeals process if you disagree with the court's decision.
Right, and it becomes a very serious issue. There's no room for discussion. There's no room for, if that particular judge, in fact, I think in Connie's case, because the judge rotated out and there was another judge on the bench at the time, he granted the excuse. And if he hadn't been there, she still could have been in that situation. Now, in talking to a representative from the Judicial Department about some way to modify that somehow, they do have, and I believe it's an administrative process that they work with for Americans with Disabilities Act, where there's a problem with someone under the ADA serving as to how that is dealt with, and if it's not satisfactory, then there's a review for it. So there's some consideration doing something along those lines.
But under the ADA, they're not permitted just to give a blanket exemption to people who have disabilities, because that also would be in violation of the ADA.
Right. My point is that they have set up an appeals-type process or a review process that if something similar could be done for 10.050, that would be very helpful, because in the two situations that I'm familiar with here, we've had people who were told you either serve on jury duty or you go to jail. They may have understood, well, it's possible, I got a contempt citation, I can go to court, etc., and it's just beyond their ability to cope with. I mean,
obviously that they're trying to be intimidated.
There's a strong intimidation factor when you go before a judge and you're told this is the way the law is. You don't know what else to do. And there's a certain sense of panic that sets in. However, I'd like to keep the focus of this, and we try to make the focus of this not so much on the parent or the caregiver as much as it is on the child and the child's needs and how the child's needs can be best addressed. I listened over the past couple of weeks to a lot of testimony on the floor about different things being done for children and bills being done for children, etc. And in talking again with the Residential Judicial Department, even the Chief Justice perspective was, it's a hard call. This is a difficult situation. And we do recognize that. We want, however, for the parent not to be put in a really tight binding situation as has happened here, and that if it can be looked at from the perspective of the parent is already performing a civic duty, and that therefore there could be a deferral of jury duty, then I think that would be something that really all parties could be acceptable to.
Thank you. Other questions? We have one other witness on this, and I'll invite her now, Ingrid Swenson.
Thank you, Chair Bryant, members of the committee. Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Listening to the testimony certainly causes one to be concerned about the manner in which jury duty is imposed on our citizens, and we certainly understand that there can be cases such as these, and agree that something needs to be done to allow people in those situations to meet their duty without making the kinds of choices that these folks were required to make. However, exempting pregnant women from jury duty and taking that course of action is not a good one. We oppose the exemption for a person 70 years and older. Certainly there are individual cases which need attention, but to give blanket exemptions on the basis of an abuse of discretion in the past would not appear to be the best solution. If indeed there were 3% of the population of potential jurors who were affected by this measure, and I don't know what the percentage would be for jurors over 70, we have already significantly narrowed the jury pool by just those two exemptions. And I can't imagine that in the future you won't be asked to make exemptions for people with medical conditions whose hardships were not recognized by the court, or people with employment situations which were just literally impossible for them to manage. And I guess the other thing I would like to remind the committee of is that, in fact, parties do have a constitutional right to a jury which represents a cross-section of the community. The point will come if there are a series of exemptions where the criteria no longer meets that cross-section requirement. I know other states are looking at pieces of this, but it's clear that if it affects too much of the population, you've violated the constitutional requirement. I guess our suggestion to the committee would be to consider an interim effort to identify some other process, short of the contempt process, for allowing people to have some other kind of procedure for being exempted in special cases. And there are committees within the Judicial Department who might appropriately look at them. One might be the Access to Justice Committee, for example, because jury duty is not just a right, but it's obviously also an obligation. And that committee is concerned with both the obligation and the right of citizens to serve. So I don't know what other judicial department groups might appropriately look at it, but that would be our suggestion.
Thank you. Question for Ingrid. Thank you, Justin. Well, my thoughts on this would be to eliminate pregnancy and there rely on the current exemption, that I change primary caregiver to only caregiver on the exemption, and also add that the parties are unable to afford daycare. And then I would require a signed affidavit in order to obtain the excuse, which would include the normal penalties for false swearing, and that would be a form developed by the Judicial Department. Otherwise, you're going to have people who are just don't want to serve that would somehow try to use this exception to avoid it. And I would want it to be a criminal penalty if, in fact, they were guilty of false swearing. But those are my ideas. If we want to proceed with this bill, that's cool.
The chairman wants to tell you. Should I get your notes?
Yes. In fact, I'll pass these notes on.
Okay.
Close the working session on Senate Bill 1304, and we have one final bill on the Senate Chief's bill. So, if you could get her, Mr. Taylor,
and there's a dash one amendment in front of you too.
All right, and I'll open the working session on Senate Bill 1247.
I give a courtesy vote, yeah.
Oh.
Staff and one change for it.
Senator Cusub, we're in work session on Senate Bill 1247. I thought Mr. Taylor could explain the amendments, and then you could make comments on the amendments.
Chair, members of the committee, the dash one amendments combine the suggestions of the State Treasurer's Department and DAS, and that would be the amendments that you see on page 1, lines 5 through 16. And then the other amendments starting on page 2 would be the amendments that was suggested by, I believe, a wagon hut that would make it just a little bit easier for any one that would have to operate under. What we did on page 2 was the section 4, a private provider that operates a correctional facility is liable to the state or its political subdivision for direct and personal and equipment costs of providing emergency public security services. We took it out, Mr. Chairman of the Committee, because really that's something that probably should be negotiated through contract. They talked about at the hearing reasonable costs. And this whole bill is a balance act between what should be in statute and what would be in the contract, in this case, between the Correctional Privatization Commission. And going through it, we just decided we could take that out. And then on the other language, it is basically that a private provider that operates a correctional facility under contract with the Correctional Privatization Commission must meet the standards adopted by the commission under the section within 2 years after entering the contract. So that would give them a period of time to meet the standards. Otherwise, you may say they might have to meet them immediately upon entering into the contract, and that may be almost a chicken and egg problem.
Thank you, Deb.
Basically, the Treasury Department said that this language needs to be in a bill and use orders or whatever. And I would agree about the contract issue, too. If we try to put every single thing in the language of this statute, I think that it's rather limiting on one hand. And we might leave out something, and I think that we should have some flexibility with the contract, and that is the whole purpose of the commission actually having that function, and they would be fairly specialized in the whole issue. So.
Okay. Would you like to move the Dash 1 amendment?
I would move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1247.
Senator Q-Tub moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1247.
Discussion? Objection?
Mr. Chair, I will give my colleague the courtesy to vote, but I may not be able on the floor.
On the floor?
Right.
And you won't have to do that right away because it would go down to Ways and Means because of the cost of the commission. So the Senator Q-Tub then would move that this matter go to Ways and Means as amended with the DuPlanch recommendation. Discussion? Objection?
I'll give a courtesy vote also, but I may be a no vote on the floor if it ever gets to that point. I go by the old yellow page thing, the Indianapolis scenario, you know. It says if you want to privatize something, look at the yellow pages. I look at the yellow pages, I don't say anything about prisons. I don't do any of that, so that's sort of a philosophical thing about that.
But one of the reasons is that's because we have a monopoly in Oregon.
Right.
They wouldn't be allowed to operate.
But there might be a reason.
Well, probably the statute.
The reason is the statute, and I'd read the report.
Well, there's private prisons throughout the country, and they just, you know, you don't. And what I see is that at least the prisons that I've visited in the state of Oregon, they're over probably half privatized with the services that they perform inside of them right now. There's a lot of privatization already existing within our prisons right now.
Well, the motion to Ways and Means does carry. Discussion will continue. And that does it for the day. We adjourned early. Yeah, let's go ahead and do that. Okay. And